access number 6447, Real One.
Conversation with Colonel John Roberts, commanding officer of 16 Field Ambulance.
On the 2nd of April 1982, the Falkland Islands were invaded by Argentina. I personally first heard the news on the car radio driving home that Friday evening. And it did occur to me at that stage even that my unit might be involved, since 5 Infantry Brigade, which was the brigade which would be expected to go to an overseas option, didn't in fact have the logistic support of its own that it needed. In particular, it did not have a field ambulance. On the 4th of April, a conference was held at headquarters 5 Infantry Brigade so that contingency planning for possible intervention operations could begin. The conference was attended by brigade staff officers, commanders of all brigade units, and commanders of certain units from other formations which were deemed necessary should the operation be launched. One of these units, of course, was 16 Field Ambulance. It was stressed at the time that none of the invited units were under command, that notice to move remained at 7 days, and that consequently no firm action was to be taken toward preparing for deployment. In the event, neither the command status nor the notice to move were to change for some weeks, making the bidding for manpower and equipment extremely difficult. With its attached, but still not under command, units, 5 Brigade held a work-up exercise, Welsh Falcon, in Sennybridge from the 22nd to the 29th of April. The 2 parachute battalions had been replaced by the 2nd Battalion Scots Guards and the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards, as 3 para had already sailed south with 3 Commando Brigade, and 2 para, together with the parachute clearing troop of 16 Field Ambulance, were due to sail in MV Norland on the 25th of April. After a great deal of discussion and many changes in staff tables, the final shape of 5 Brigade on light scales was agreed, both men and equipment, and the process of reinforcing and re-equipping at the 11th hour was undertaken. The brigade finally put to sea in the 2 ferries, Baltic and Nordic, on the 10th of May, and also on the RMS Queen Elizabeth II on the 12th of May. 16 Field Ambulance had put 2 collecting sections with their vehicles and all the unit's equipment on the 2 ferries, whereas the bulk of the unit, including 2 surgical teams, their equipment, and 2 Mexicab blood trailers, were embarked on QE2. The bulk of the unit vehicles followed later in Atlantic Causeway. On the 20th of May, the 16 Field Ambulance follow-up party flew to Ascension and joined the main body. On the 21st of May, the parachute clearing troop landed at San Carlos on East Falkland Island and helped to establish the surgical centre together with the medical squadron of the Commander Logistic Regiment, and they did this in the refrigeration plant at Ajax Bay, later carrying out the majority of the surgery performed there. The main body of 16 Field Ambulance, together with the 1st 7th Gurkha Rifles, transferred from the QE2 to MV Norland at Gritvigan, South Georgia, on the 28th of May, and set sail for the Falklands, having first detached a collecting section to each of the 3 battalions. These collecting sections each comprised of 1 doctor and 9 medical assistants. On the 1st of June, the unit disembarked at San Carlos, where it acted as reserve to the medical squadron at Ajax Bay, whilst it waited to be joined by the 2 sections and the equipment from the ferries. The remainder of the brigade, including brigade headquarters, arrived at San Carlos on the 2nd of June. On the night of the 6th and 7th of June, an advanced dressing station was deployed forward to Fitzroy, partially by helicopter and partially by the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, Sir Tristram. The main body of 16 Field Ambulance followed up on the night of the 7th and 8th of June in another Fleet Auxiliary, Sir Galahad, together with 2 companies of Welsh Guards. On the morning of the 8th of June, only a small party from 16 Field Ambulance, including the commanding officer, the command post, and part of 1 surgical team, but without its theatre, had gone ashore at Fitzroy when the two LSLs, Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram, were bombed by enemy aircraft and severely damaged. As a result of the attack, 16th Field Ambulance lost 3 men killed, including the second in command, and all of its equipment. Over the next 3 hours, the advanced dressing station treated and evacuated 135 casualties, of whom 18 were from 16th Field Ambulance itself, but the majority of the remainder were Welsh Guardsmen. Most of the casualties were suffering from burns. All survivors of the attack, both fit and casualties, were evacuated to Ajax Bay. On the 10th and 11th of June, most of the 16 Field Ambulance survivors, including some of the minor casualties, returned to Fitzroy, together with part of the parachute clearing troop, less in fact one of its surgical teams, that being deployed to Teal Inlet. Of the remaining two surgical teams, one was retained at Ajax Bay and one returned to Fitzroy. We were then able to set up, or thus able to set up, at Fitzroy, what I can only describe as a MASH, for we had an advanced dressing station and we also had two surgical teams and a nursing holding section. From the 11th to the 15th of June, during the final battle for Stanley, the bulk of the casualties were passed through 16 Field Ambulance at Fitzroy. The total treated at Fitzroy between the 7th and 18th of June was 437. There were also two brought in dead. On the 21st of June, the surgical element of 16 Field Ambulance returned to Stanley for onward transmission to UK. The remainder of the unit remained in Fitzroy until it was able to board Uganda and sail for UK on the 19th of July.
Right. John, that sounded obviously very efficient, very straightforward and very easy as a potted history of the Falklands campaign from your unit's point of view, but I know very well that it wasn't as easy as that. Can I take you right back to the beginning? What were your feelings when you knew you were definitely going to go to the Falklands and that possibly you may be going to war? Because as a soldier, as well as a doctor, that, after all, is what you're trained for. But I don't think you have actually experienced this before.
No, this is quite true. Like most soldiers today, I've served several times in Northern Ireland. But this was an entirely different type of war. There was the potential for an entirely different type of war, because at this stage I don't think anybody really believed that shots would be fired. I think we all felt that on the sort of gunboat diplomacy front, once the task force sailed, that there would possibly be a backing down of the opposition, and that we all were going to spend X weeks lying on Ascension Island sunning ourselves. Certainly the thought of going was exhilarating. The unit had immensely high morale, probably higher than I can ever remember it. And we really couldn't wait to go. We left Southampton, as you know, at 4 o'clock on the dot of the afternoon of the 12th of May in QE2, to the most momentous departure I can recall since I joined the service. It was a most tear-jerking and yet exciting departure. It really was quite amazing. From there, southward, it certainly took us 2 to 3 days to get used to the routine of the ship. QE2 really is quite enormous compared to any ship that any of us had ever sailed in. I believe she's over 1,000 feet long, and it's rather like a huge block of flats, but self-contained, almost a village. It's a very curious feeling, I can tell you, going to war, on the one hand living in a penthouse suite and eating smoked salmon, and on the other hand zigzagging all over the Atlantic because of the possible submarine threat, and of course as we got closer to the south, the air threat. When we in fact approached, we in fact went first to Freetown in Sierra Leone, where we refueled and took on some water. And on arrival at Freetown, the first thing we saw was a Russian trawler, which was fascinated by our ship, more likely by its contents. and we left Sierra Leone the day we arrived. In fact, we left late that evening in the dark, and we slipped quietly out of Sierra Leone, and we motored on south towards Ascension. When we neared Ascension Island, again to our surprise, we didn't actually go to Ascension. And the rumour, and I think I must stress here, that when you have 4,000 people in a ship, rumours appear magically. They circulate. And the rumour was, and it was a reasonable one, that since there was a submarine missing, and I think you have to remember here that we had known that the Argentinians had four submarines. We knew we had sunk one. We knew where two of them were. But we really didn't know at all where the third one was. And although this was only allegedly a coastal submarine, in fact, it was quite capable, I believe, of reaching the Needles if it really had to. So we knew we had a submarine somewhere in the Atlantic. The principle adopted was that the QE2, rather like the two queens in the last war, was such a fast ship that unless she were incredibly unlucky and happened to find herself steaming straight at a submarine, any submarine coming across QE2 would see his target going rapidly across the horizon before he could draw a bead, as it were. And I think this was the theory on which we motored at high speed down the south, down to the Atlantic. And in fact, we were making 25, 26 knots the entire time. As we got near to Ascension, we were told that we would not actually be going into Ascension or dropping anchor. And it became clear that this was because dropping anchor at Ascension, where everybody knew the British forces were phasing, would be really asking for the torpedo, which we'd all been thinking about. So in fact, we circled beyond the horizon, Ascension. And while this was going on, we had certain helicopter operations. People were being ferried to and from the island. Stores were being ferried from Ascension. And indeed, as I've already said, my own follow-up party arrived, commanded by my second-in-command from Ascension. They, in fact, had a very unfortunate journey. They were loaded onto a small grey ship, a fisheries protection ship, Dumbarton Castle. And I understand that she and her sister ship, Leeds Castle, had only just been commissioned. This was, in effect, their maiden voyage. And Dumbarton Castle, certainly compared to QE2, was minute. And although we were motoring along very, very solidly, Dumbarton Castle was bobbing about like a cork.
They went all the way from Southampton to Ascension?
No, they didn't, happily. They had been collected. They flew to Ascension, where they were then popped onto this little ship and sent out to find QE2. And they found us, and then there was helicopter transfer from Dumbarton Castle to QE2. When I first saw my second-in-command, Roger, he was lying in his cabin.
This is Roger Nutbeam.
Roger Nutbeam, yes. He was lying in his cabin, sort of pale green. He didn't really want to see or speak to anybody. And in fact, he felt like this for a couple of days. He certainly was no sailor. And yet the next morning, to his horror, this is Roger, to his horror, the next morning we woke up to find Ascension sitting there on the horizon. Clearly the threat had been reassessed, and we could now approach. So all these people who'd spent a very unhappy 6 hours in this little ship could have, in fact, have avoided it had they waited a day. Mm. That's just one of the things. We then circled Ascension again, and more helicopter operations. And then we set off for the south. Now, at this point, we didn't know whether we were going to the Falklands or whether we were going to South Georgia. And so we zigzagged. Physically, we probably zigzagged not so many times. Mentally, we were zigzagging every hour because the various threats, I think if one accepts that there was a possibility always that Russian intelligence might have been helping the Argentinians. If one accepts this, then clearly one wants to avoid anything Russian. Hence the concern about the trawler at Freetown. Hence, when we got to a little bit south, when we got south of Ascension, We then went further out into the Atlantic, further west, for fear of being spotted perhaps by Russian aircraft coming out from Angola. So we went out further west. Suddenly we then started to steam further east, because somebody had said, good Lord, if they can fit Exocet to Etendard, which the French tell us they can't do, what is to stop them fitting Exocet to Boeing 707, which we knew they had, and which had the range to reach us? So we then went further east. And so this zigzagging pattern continued throughout the whole journey, punctuated both by the smoked salmon and the thoughts of torpedoes. It was really fascinating. One could wake up in the morning, go out and see a glorious dawn with the sun coming up and the light streaming down from the clouds. Quite magnificent. Take beautiful pictures, and then you see a machine gun, and you remember what you're there for. Because at this stage, by now, we had got GPMG machine guns mounted on pintles, and we had both, we had 0.5 inch Browning machine guns as well. All there against air attack.
How did you cope with the sort of immobility and the lack of space on the jet? Because you've been at sea now for several weeks.
This is right. Well, several weeks. In fact, no. We arrived at Ascension. When was it? On about the on the 20th of May. So we'd actually been at sea only 8 days then.
Yes.
The ship's quite fast, you see, making 26 knots.
Yes.
We eventually got to South Georgia on the 28th of May. So again, it's only 16 days, in fact. But what we did, there were detailed training programs for all units. The infantry did a lot of running and a lot of weapon training. There was a lot of shooting, firing of rockets and firing of small arms across the from the both the aft and the forward end of the ship. In my unit, we did the same thing. Of course, we did a certain amount of arms training. We did a lot of fitness training. Running around the ship, it's quite a big circuit actually, if you think of it, 1,000 feet long. That's 2,000 feet, the whole circuit of the ship. And although we couldn't go right up to the front, we were able, or the unit was able, to run round, up round about bridge level, and then down again back onto the decks. And so we were able to make out a circuit, and all the units did this. They also had the large sort of dance halls, which were able to run about and do PT on. And they were able to do PT later on the helicopter deck and the aft of the ship. Also, my unit, of course, was deeply involved with first aid training for all units of the brigade. And we had a program of lectures on first aid, hygiene, immediate resuscitation, all sorts of things like this. We also, in fact, set up one of our two theatres in one of the dance halls, because it had occurred to me that were the ship to be hit by an Exocet, the ship's hospital itself, down at sort of sea level, tiny little hospital, the newspapers will tell you it was a 6 or 7 ward hospital, but of course they didn't say that each ward had one bed in it. So it was a tiny hospital. I think it had 13 beds and a small operating theatre. Totally inadequate, had we been hit by a missile. Mm. So I'd instructed that two sites were to be found for the theatres, one at each end of the ship, and each one within easy access to a helicopter deck. And they were in, one was in a restaurant at the front by the forward helicopter deck, and the other one was in a dance floor at the back, again by a helicopter deck. We set up one of the theatres there, and the teams, now these were ad hoc teams that were made up for the journey, so although they knew each other, they hadn't worked as a team. So they set up, in fact, one theatre, and they sort of familiarise themselves with a kit. And then, to their glee, one soldier, I think it was a soldier, was foolish enough to develop appendicitis. And that appendix was out so fast. In fact, it was out before the majority of us realised that the chap even had one. Quite incredible. And the team then felt that they were blooded, and they were now a proper team. Which meant that the second team began to scour the ship, looking for anything to do, and I think the brigade commander was in grave danger of losing his appendix or something. So this was the training on the way down. As we got nearer to South Georgia, say round about the 26th of May, the weather got a bit rougher, and quite honestly we were bouncing about a bit, and it would have been foolish to have tried any more fitness training on the decks, because people would end up hurting themselves, and this is the last thing we wanted, with a lot of twisted ankles before arriving. So the formal training stopped. At this stage, all the way down, I have to stress, of course, that we didn't even have the radar switched on, and all sorts of communications were minimized. Because radar, as you know, can be picked up, because it's a transmitting device.
And was it generally known at that stage that you were going to South Georgia rather than...
No, it wasn't. Oh, it wasn't. We still didn't know. And in fact, on the 27th of May, I think it was, the Brigadier's recce party transferred to HMS Antrim by helicopter and lifeboat, in fact. We tried it with helicopter. It was so bouncy that we then did it with the ship's lifeboats. And they then transferred to HMS Antrim. And they then went off to meet up with 3 Commando Brigade headquarters to reassess the situation on the ground. Because, of course, at this stage, the one thing I missed out was that throughout this journey, we were listening to the World Service, and we knew, of course, what was going on. 21st of May had been D-Day, when 3 Commando Brigade landed, and at this stage, it became more likely, we felt, that we would be committed. Not, as it was initially thought, as garrison force. Not, as had secondarily been thought, as a reserve. But now it became clear that we would possibly be phase two of an operation.
Yes.
So this had happened, and this became clearer to us after the 21st of May, after D-Day, because the Argentinians did fight, and therefore it seemed reasonable that they would continue to fight until they were overcome. And the one brigade that was on the ground seemed not sufficient, you know, for the number of forces they had. Now, after we transferred this small recce group, I say small, it was about 30 or 40 strong, onto Antrim, which were second in commands of most of the units, including Roger Nutbeam, who went on my behalf. Mm. Then we headed towards South Georgia, and then, to my horror, I saw the radar sort of whizzing round on the mast, and both radars going, in fact, and I went forward and I said, you know, this is rather strange. I mean, clearly there's a reason. To which a ship's officer pointed at an enormous iceberg and said, there you are, Colonel, that's the reason. And in fact, we had entered an ice field, and they were quite huge. I was amazed. There was one iceberg there, which the ship's officers measured with a sextant. And I think it was something like 1.25 times the length of QE2, and nearly twice as high.
Yes.
And I think it would have made a very, very nasty dent in us had we hit it.
And you were still quite a long way north of South Georgia.
Oh, yes, yes. And we were heading toward it. And at this stage, we then started to turn, and we were then headed for South Georgia. Yeah. We gathered that there had been a decision, a cabinet-level decision, in fact, that QE2 was not to be risked. She was, in fact, she would have been a prestige target, and politically this would have been very unacceptable to have lost, a prestige target in the form of the ship, and B, of course, one mustn't forget, an entire brigade of soldiers.
Yes.
Which would have been a very expensive torpedo, bomb, exocet, whatever you like. So it was decided at this stage that QE2 would have to go to South Georgia. The brigade would then transship into Canberra and Norland, both of which had been used for the commando landing earlier and were now to be made available to us. As we approached South Georgia, the fog came down, and we had this happy business of motoring towards South Georgia in thick fog with icebergs all over the place. The only advantage, of course, is that when you've got thick fog and so on, that it's very unlikely that you're going to be hit by any aircraft. We then arrived at South Georgia. I think we arrived, yes, on the 28th of May. No, we arrived, I think, on the night of the 27th of May, in fact, at about 6 o'clock, South Georgia. It was just like the old London pea soup fog. And, in fact, one little ship approached us. She was, in fact, Dumbarton Castle's sister ship, Leeds Castle. She approached and immediately wiped off her HF antenna on our bridge overhang, which shows, A, the size of QE2 relative to the other ship. It also shows how poor the visibility was, because I don't think he actually saw our bridge overhang from where he was.
As close as that.
Yeah. And from then on, stores and men were transferred from then on by tugs. We had two deep sea tugs, and they were transferring the men and equipment. The two Guards battalions and the brigade headquarters transferred to Canberra. My unit and 1st 7th Gurkha Rifles transferred to MV Norland. It's the North Sea Ferry. We set sail the next evening for the Falklands. This, in fact, was 28th to 9:30. This was a three-day journey. And we, in fact, arrived at San Carlos Bay on the morning of the 1st of June.